From training to performing, join our big league conversation. Welcome to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast with your host, Eric Cressy.
Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 82. Today's guest is one of the most accomplished relief pitchers in Major League history and also a guy who's on this year's Hall of Fame ballot again. As you'll learn, he's a guy who not only pitched in a lot of high-pressure scenarios, but did so over an extended period of time. He had a 16-year Major League career, and he really threw 100 before everybody threw 100. What I also like is he's someone who's coaching now in retirement, so he has some really good insights to share on how player development has changed from when he was younger to what he's dealing with now with his son and with the players he coaches. So this is going to be a really good show on a number of fronts, and I think you'll really like it as much as I did. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. It's an all-in-one superfood supplement with 75 whole food sourced ingredients to support your body's nutritional needs across five critical areas: energy, immunity, gut health, hormonal support, and healthy aging. I'm an avid user of Athletic Greens myself, in spite of the fact that I tend to be a supplement minimalist. To me, this is a product that is much more like whole food nutritional insurance as opposed to a true supplement. The ingredients have been carefully selected at the highest quality, most natural source. You get essential vitamins and minerals, digestive enzymes, prebiotics, probiotics, and that's a zero compromise approach from the company. It's plant-based, sourced from whole foods at the highest quality. So you won't find harmful chemicals, artificial colors or flavors, preservatives or added sugar. Really, it's perfect for folks who are gluten and dairy free, paleo, keto, vegan friendly, great for people who are intermittent fasting, all that fun stuff. Personally, I love it for obviously our athletes who don't get enough nutritional benefits from fruits and vegetables because they don't eat enough. So it's a way to kind of plug in holes in diets. But also, I really like it for our college and professional athletes who may have complex travel schedules where quality food options aren't always at hand. On a personal level, I'm a husband, father of three, and an entrepreneur. We split our time between two states, and I'm also still an avid lifter. So life is inherently crazy, and it can be stressful, and sleep deprivation is definitely something that we encounter. So I rely on Athletic Greens for part of my immune support and believe firmly that it's made a big difference in keeping me healthy in spite of how crazy our lifestyle is. They've got a great offer in place. If you head to athleticgreens.com/Cressy, they'll get you 20 free travel packets with your purchase. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y, and you can claim your special offer. Today's guest grew up in Virginia and graduated high school as a 5'5", 135-pound football and baseball player. In spite of spectacular high school baseball numbers as both a hitter and left-handed pitcher, he was overlooked by college and pro scouts. He wound up attending Ferrum College in Virginia and once there, focused on baseball. In 1992, he set single-season NCAA records for strikeouts per nine innings and fewest hits allowed per nine innings. He was drafted 12th overall by the Houston Astros in 1993 and made his MLB debut 2 years later at the age of 24. Over a 16-year MLB career, he played for the Astros, Phillies, Mets, Red Sox, and Braves. He retired at age 39 with a career 2.31 ERA, 422 saves, and 1,196 strikeouts in 903 innings pitched. Of all pitchers with at least 800 innings pitched in MLB history, his 11.9 K per 9 and 33.2% strikeout rate are both the best. Opposing batters hit only 187 against him, which is lowest in MLB history for anyone with 800 plus innings pitched. In 2019, he was inducted into the National College Baseball Hall of Fame, and he's currently on the ballot for Cooperstown for the sixth time. Since his retirement, he's been coaching high school baseball in Virginia. Please welcome to the show, Billy Wagner.
Welcome to the show, Billy.
Well, it's great to be here. I appreciate getting the opportunity.
I was telling you off air, I'm very excited about this because, you know, I was a baseball fan for a long time, but I became a Billy Wagner follower when we had Tim Collins working his way through the minor leagues as a, you know, a smaller stature left-handed pitcher. Your story really parallels his in a lot of ways. You were 5'5", 135 when you graduated high school. So it was obviously a quick arm, but maybe it went underappreciated by college and pro scouts because of your size. So I'm curious, talk to me about maybe how your body and your velocity changed from that point at age 18 when you finished, you know, high school to where you were, you know, 3 years later when you're taken in the first round? Like, what did you discover in those 3 years of college?
You know, it's funny. Everything happened within a 6 month period for me.
Interesting.
I graduated. You know, I'm in that 5'5", 5'7", 135 pounds. I'm going to college to play nothing but football. Baseball is just what we do for when we're not playing football. It was, you know, that was that era that you could do that. There was no specialized training. So, so I go and I'm playing football and I'm playing with monsters. And so you're in the weight room, a little bit more. College gives you that opportunity to stay in there, a little bit more consistency, not as time constrained. And so I'm in there a little bit more. All of a sudden, you know, I grow 4 inches. I gain like 40 pounds. You know, not that makes me a whole lot bigger, but all of a sudden, you know, I go from 78, 82 in high school to 88, 90, 92, 95 by the end of my freshman year. And it was, you know, I contribute to a couple of things. First of all, you know, God-given, blessed beyond rapport. But second, I think it was one of those things where it just took time for maturity to kind of kick in. I was always kind of, I don't know if I'd say disproportionate. I always had big legs. Mm-hmm. I think it's a family trait. My dad and my uncles, my dad's side, our tallest guy might be 6'1". Mm-hmm. So height wasn't a big thing, but we were more football, bottom half players. So I you know, go to Fair and play football, weight room. I was always big. I'd always had a good arm. I just didn't have that velocity. I mean, I at one time I swore I could throw a football harder than I could throw a baseball. and that's where my arm stroke came from, being pretty much a short arm, pusher. Is because I threw a football, and I lived throwing a football. Even on the football team, I was a defensive back, but I would run scout team offense for the first team defense, and so I was always throwing a football. And so I think building the arm strength and just hand strength, finger strength, all those things that come into being able to spin a baseball, went hand in hand. And then it was just the chip on your shoulder. I mean, you go out there, you're 5 foot nothing, 100 and nothing, and you're facing Michael Tuckers and guys like that in college, where, you know, they got their name, you don't really know where you're at. And so that was really how it just kind of just evolved really quickly.
I think one of the things that just, you know, kind of popped in my head as you're describing that is we'll talk later about how you're coaching now, is just that the multi-sport athlete, it's a dying breed, unfortunately. And, you know, you hear your story, you're, you know, a football guy first, baseball kind of happened. You were also that athlete, correct me if I'm wrong, you broke one arm, you broke your right arm, and then learned how to throw lefty. Is that story correct? Still accurate? So, I mean,
yeah,
that takes a lot of movement variability to take something on like that. Would you have defined yourself as like a, you know, just kind of a naturally skilled athlete that picked up new tasks, you know, easily? Were you that guy that was always playing something different in the backyard growing up?
You know what? I was always doing something. I was always, always, always throwing something. Rocks, acorns, something, always. You know, sports has always been a part of my family's life growing up. I mean, I just can't even imagine not playing a sport. I mean, you know, you were always compared to your uncles and cousins, and it was just always that competition within the competition. And so I think that was, you know, something that was, you know, and to some extent lost, but at this point, but, you know, being a multi-sport guy, I wouldn't say I was at that point, I wouldn't say I was good at any of them, but I could hold my own. But I believe that, you know, having that in that age group, you know, being able to play multiple sports, I was always throwing. I don't think there's a day off, even in the winter, when I wasn't throwing something. But I think it was just the different body movements you had to have. You didn't know then, but that it contributed to being, you know, an all-around athlete. And I mean, you can tell today as a high school coach, I see it even more when I have kids. You know, I coach at a private school, in Charlottesville. And when I get transfer kids come in that have played football, they're always completely different than the kid who's just been playing baseball. Mm-hmm. And so you almost, a lot of our drills and a lot of the things that we do is almost create a football mobility obstacle course. I mean, we do a lot of multi-sport movements to get them into being an athlete. Because yeah, a lot of guys, they go into a weight room and they're not really sure because they're not athletic. Their hips are really tight. They don't know how to work that. A lot of their body parts to be expected. But what I'm seeing is football players, they can get in there and they know how to push something. They know how to, they're not afraid to get into it. Where, you know, a baseball player is just so unsure. They're like, oh, well, I've read, you know, shoulders. they've got some, yeah, where you just didn't think about that. Where, you know, for us is just really getting into the just competing. That yeah, was the whole thought process. Look, I'm going to compete. And it wasn't, is this right or is this wrong? I mean, it's like the pitch counts back in the day. I mean, you know, Nolan Ryan telling me stories of, you know, throwing 150 pitches. I remember in college, I mean, I threw 150 pitches on a Friday and throw relief the next 2 days and never even thought about my arm being sore.
It's a different
but
world.
But that, oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't even think about that. I mean, kids will come out of the game, how many pitches I got? You're like, mm-hmm, what? So, but I mean, that's the world we live in. But that's right. That's really how it kind of manifested, where I threw a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to be said for that. You know, what's interesting though is, I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing 15 and 16 year olds that are 95 mm-hmm, consistently. We're seeing guys mm-hmm, that are really good young, where, you know, obviously the arm speed, you know, is outpacing their physiological development, right? They're winding right up with stress fractures and ulnocollateral mm-hmm, ligament tears that young. Do you think to some degree, like, it was a little bit of a blessing in disguise that you did, you know, wind up as a little bit of a late bloomer, where that arm speed didn't come till you were, you know, 19, 20, and maybe that had something to do with your durability, you know, over the long term, is, you know, being skeletally mature by the time you surged?
Absolutely. I think, you know, as much pain and grief it caused me growing up, it paid off on the backside. And, you know, and that's one thing I preach, you know, now with some of the kids that I have coming up, you know, the eighth graders want to be juniors that are 6'3". And, you know, I've had a kid who's getting ready to graduate who's been 6'8" since he pretty much got to, in the eighth grade, since he got to our school. And I'm like, and I mean, he's just now trying to able to figure out, you know, how to, you know, run straight and yeah, arms, you know, it just takes so much maturity. And I mean, you see so much anymore where, you know, the growth, the physical growth is just so much quicker. Mm-hmm. And then what amazes me is when you look at the parents, yeah, we see more parents now that are shorter and have no background, and the kids are, you know, 6'5" and the parents are, you know, 5'8", 5'9". We see that way more often. And you're just going, is your family big? And, you know, they'll have an uncle or grandpa somewhere down the line that was, you know, of good size. But, you know, it is shocking that, you know, I don't see as much injury mm-hmm, with the late bloomer
yeah,
as I do with the kid who's 6'3", runs hard, throws harder. He, you know, he has no body control. And so his joints and everything aren't ready for it. So, you know, it's funny when you get them in there, we have to really tone it back to say, hey, okay, we've got to do a lot more, you know, joint strengthening. And so I know you can probably go in there and do some things with heavyweight, but it's no purpose. And so doing the joint control and stuff like that is, you know, how we've attacked it a little bit, just slow everybody down. I mean, because everybody wants to be committed coming at, I mean,
yeah, it's true.
I got a kid I coach now is 14 years old, and the first thing he says, I'd like to be committed by 15.
My God.
I said, I would like to have hair, and I would like to, and so, you know, it's so you really have to tone things down because they're automatically thinking these things. So, you know, yeah, I mean, the late bloomers may pay the price early, but in the long haul, I think it all works out for them.
I'm always blown away when I look at our pro baseball crowd, how many of them were late bloomers, were guys that, you know, basically, you know, they went to fringe Division I schools or, you know, they went to, you know, not a Division I school. They found a junior college or something like that, and they figured it out much later. And like you said, they discovered the weight room. Maybe they figured something out mechanically and it clicked later on. So, I get my eyebrow goes a little bit more raised every time I see another 16-year-old hitting 95 because I feel like it's a, you know, short-term gain, long-term pain scenario.
It's definitely, you kind of wonder. I mean, I believe when I came in at 24 years old in 96, I mean, there wasn't many guys, you know, touch. I think you could count on your hand how many guys have touched 100 or could pitch and hit those numbers. Where today, if you don't hit those numbers, and you have that body, so I mean, they raise the eyebrow and they're you know, kind of giving you the what's going on, what's wrong with you. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and that's in itself is just incredible. I can't even imagine. I mean, I marvel at the guys today because of just how unbelievable. When I went down to Houston and watched Cole pitch against Rays 2 years ago, and I'm sitting behind the backstop, and he's thrown into a 100 and whatever pitch in the ninth inning, and he is like, it's like ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just 100 miles an hour. You didn't see that, you know, that velocity. That, I mean, you had the Bob Gibsons and the Nolan Ryans, and you had some, you know, some freaks, but nowadays you see a Cole and Verlander and guys like that, they roll out. I mean, that's just what we do anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. That's crazy. You led into my next question. So you made your major league debut in 1995 and consistently pitched in the mid to high 90s. And as an example, in 2003, you threw 159 pitches at 100 miles per hour above. Second on the list, only had 12. That was Bartolo Colon, like in his heyday. So you threw 100 before it was cool to throw 100. I'm curious, what went into establishing that velocity in the first place? What was it that not only, I mean, we talked a little about finding the weight room and stuff like that, but we can both agree going 95 to 100 is totally different than going 90 to 95. That's a different category. Correct. So what allowed you to establish it in the first place? And then also maybe building on that, what did your in-season, you know, throwing/training regimen looked like to maintain it? So if you had to go, you know, back to back, that it was there on day two as well.
You know, it was funny. I'd always been into some type of martial arts, not confrontational martial arts, mm-hmm. but more of a way to relax and a way to control my body. And so, we had a guy in Houston who actually was, part of the like camera crew.
Interesting.
He was a veteran. He was a veteran. He had, you know, been in the military, but he, you know, got into this. And so we were out getting on a plane one night and I was mentioning how my velocity would just go. I'd be like one pitch 95, one pitch 98, one pitch be 100, you know, I was always like bouncing all around and, you know, having a hard time controlling anxiety and emotions inside. And so he mentioned something to me about martial arts. Now, I'd taken some martial arts when I was younger, but we started talking and we started taking, you know, we started getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning and going down to the weight room when we were on the road and doing, you know, 30 minutes of stretching and breathing and just kind of just relaxation and mental work. And then I'd go, when I was home, I'd go to the field and be able to get there and go through this whole regimen of relaxing and going and the process. And so what I found is once I got to that point, everything changed for me on a consistent basis. I mean, I was more consistent, and I think it really started in that 99 year, but I think everything started really came to that, you know, where I wanted to be in 03, where I was able to sit there and really, I would go out and pitch at a high level and I could do it more consistently at you know, day after day after day. I think what was just phenomenal, because it stopped going like these random numbers, and it started to clover a little bit, and my walks went down, everything kind of settled where you would think that perfect year is. And so, and a lot of it I contribute to that, but you know,
it's funny. Dwight Evans told me the same thing. I remember talking with him. He attributes a lot of his longevity and his defensive prowess in right field and in Boston those years to his martial arts background. That's really intriguing.
Well, it just led to, you know, as a power pitcher, especially little guy who has to go from, you know, tiptoe to fingertips to get everything to work right. My throwing program became a little bit less, you know, aggressive. I would still do some long toss during the week, but it wouldn't be like this. All right, you know, I'm going to do this Jose Mesa, stand on, you know, foul line to foul line and just chuck that thing into, you know, this craziness. It was a little bit more structured and stuff. And so I wasn't as fatigued. I wasn't as, it just seemed like the physical toll calmed down a little bit. And now my mental side was, you know, because I think what people don't realize is, or they probably realize, but it's hard to control, is the mental side of being an athlete overwhelms the physical part of your body. Because when you tax yourself 24/7 going, please don't screw this up, please don't screw this up, and then you get put out there, that 10 minutes of exertion has been like, you know, hundreds of hours of fatigue and pressure, because you put so much pressure on yourself. And that was the one thing that once I was able to mentally just take that deep breath and go, all right, here we go. My game, my just whole composure changed as I got there, got consistent with all my stuff.
You know, it's interesting. You just hinted at, kind of your in-season throwing program and taking a step back and just your catch play. We talked about Tim Collins, and Timmy was a guy who responded incredibly well to a really, you know, kind of aggressive long toss program in the minor leagues when he was in, you know, high A, double A, and that was a big part of his velo jumping. The difference with the minor leagues, it's very predictable, right? You're going to probably throw every third day. Maybe the day after you throw, mm-hmm. you go stretch it out to, you know, 240 to 300, whatever you want to do. And I'll never forget, I had a conversation with him in 2012. So he had, you know, around 70 appearances, a couple of years running. And I asked him in season, I was like, hey, when's the last time you long toss 300? He's like, I do it about half the days each year. They just happen to catch it at 60 feet, 6 inches. So the mindset was always like, I'm getting my high level intent when they're on the mound. Seems like that was some of the same stuff for you. But what I'm curious about is, what was the off season like? Were you a guy that had a pretty progressive long toss program? What did you like to do from, you know, when did you start up, you know, and what did it look like going from beginning to end when you actually were reporting to spring training?
It was funny, based on playoffs, I would attempt to take off 3 weeks to a month. Okay. I would just detox, try to stay in some shape, lift, you know, a couple times a week. But then really, as going into December, that's when I would crank back. I wouldn't start throwing until the end of December. But I would do a lot. December and January would be my crush months. And I would just go straight at it, weight room, five, 6 days a week, conditioning. I was a Gene Coleman belief that, you know, I definitely had to be in shape. If I was in shape, I'd make better decisions. I would be physically ready to do everything I need to do. So I ran miles. I felt like when I was playing, I was on the track team more than you know, a pitcher at times. And it was that combination of high intensity training of, you know, 30 seconds of sprints with, you know, going in and doing another type of push up, pull up, something just to get that heart rate up. And so I would go through lifting until probably in that 1st of February, where then I'd start to tone it down and become a little bit more, movement oriented. But when I started throwing in January, it was always hard because I didn't really have a throwing partner. And me and a friend of mine, Chris Haney, would throw. And Chris is playing with he was going to Cleveland. And so we'd started to play catch. But, you know, I was a guy who, you know, he would throw 3 days a week. I would throw every day. Mm-hmm. And I could start throwing and I would be loose in five throws.
That's a reliever right there.
Absolutely. And you know, and it became that way as it evolved because I remember being in Houston, early and getting called on, and I'm up. I'm in the bullpen, and you know, I throw, and I really didn't know how to evaluate myself, and I'd throw 50 pitches warming up, and then go on the mound, throw another 20, and I'd be exhausted. And so I figured out that, you know, I could just go out there and kind of how to do it. And so 5 pitches in, I'm done. I'm ready, and I'm like, hey, I know what I need to do now. And so my next amount of time, but you know, but that's how I would warm up with that's just how my mentality would be, because I didn't want to be left not ready. And I was so scared that I say to this day, I would tell every manager, I said, when you get me up, it takes me 5 pitches. I remember telling Larry Durker, Jimmy Williams, Willie Randolph, I was like, it don't take me no time. So, you know, don't feel like you got to sit there and wait till bases are loaded. Because mm-hmm. my biggest fear is bases loaded. I hated to come in there, bases loaded. And so I'm like, hey, I'm ready. I'd literally tell coaches when they call down to tell them I'm ready, because I knew that what they would do. And mm-hmm. so when me and Chris would play, I mean, I'd be loose and ready. He's still going through, and he was kind of a long relief guy and been a starter. And he was a little older than me, and so he would take forever getting loose. I'd be like, holy cow! But I watch kids today. And when I'm training kids, you know, I watch when they come to me, and their first thing is they've got this elaborate turn and this wrist thing they like to do. And I'm always kind of just looking around, kind of just, you know, because it is what makes you feel good is what makes you play good, mm-hmm. kind of thing. But, you know, I'm also going, well, when are you going to have time to do that if I call down there and try to get you in the game? Are you going to do all that before you come in the game?
You're going to be able to adjust.
Right.
You know, one of the things I've always noticed, and I think it's even more so true of relievers, you know, for me, I always think the reliever that made 75 appearances is more banged up than the starter that threw 200 innings in many cases when you see these guys at the end. But there's always kind of this awkward dynamic when they go through it for the first time where they don't know the difference between rested and ready, right? They say, I feel awesome. But in reality, they've just felt recuperated from the previous season, but they haven't necessarily prepared. Did you find yourself in like that weird middle ground, you know, when it's late January? Were there times when I was like, man, I just haven't had enough time to get my work in? Because you were historically on pretty good teams and in the postseason a fair amount. Did that catch you at all during your career? Was it something you learned to manage?
You know what? I had years where it would affect me different. I remember with Houston, we'd get to the playoffs, but it'd be a really short run. I always got the come in and throw the, you know, bottom, you know, top of the ninth or whatever. We're losing. We're playing the Braves. So, I mean, I always got that token. I very rarely had a stressful, really stressful inning for a while. You know, so once I got to New York, that was, and, you know, being there, New York playoffs is completely different than anything I have ever been a part of. I mean, it's incredible. And so going into, you know, the second round of the playoffs was the first time I'd ever done it. I say it to this day, like in 06, I had nothing. I had absolute velocity would say 96, 97. And that thing looked like a beach ball and be flat. I had nothing. And so, you know, I learned a lot from that about, you know, you can't learn that until you kind of go through that. But, you know, because I would usually get somewhere around 78 to, 68 to maybe 75 innings. you know, not counting the 75 innings I got up in the bullpen, but I wasn't usually wore out by the end of the season. There was times where, you know, you had that, but really it was just that 06 where I ran into the, like, just like, holy cow, the, how many games we play? I think we played 10 more games, mm-hmm. but those 10 more games in the postseason were nothing I'd really ever been through. And so that when I got home, I took a month off, and I was exhausted. I'd never been so mentally wore out and physically wore out in all my life. I mean, just nothing. I didn't want to do anything, and I can't even imagine. It amazes me when you watch Mariano, who is, I mean, every year that's just what you did. Yeah, that's what made him so unreal, because that pressure right there is. If you haven't went through a New York playoff, you have no idea what that feels like.
And what's interesting is what I think was the coolest thing when I did some homework before this. Age 39, your 16th year in the big leagues, you struck out 104 guys and only walked 22 in 69 and a third innings. You were still touching triple digits as well. So I'm curious, you know, we certainly talked about lessons you learned over the years. What was it that you learned that allowed you to hold your velocity into your late 30s, especially you had a flexor tendon surgery in 2000, you had Tommy John in 2009. Mm-hmm. What was it that allowed you to, I mean, obviously there's a genetic component. Do you think it was just that you built such a high level of work capacity and arm speed early on, or were there big adjustments that happened from, say, 35 to 39 that you learned?
I think there was things that were changed, but I think it was not this massive overhaul. It was, understanding that contact was way better if you could get it earlier. Mm-hmm. But less pitches, knowing how to control myself through a season. I think 2010 was unique because I don't know if I could have thrown a ball any better. I don't know if I could have had a better year. But I felt like it was one of those years where you feel like everything was effortless. Mm-hmm. I really didn't feel taxed. I never had that game or two or three games in a row where, you know, I'm 20, 25 pitches in a row or just, you know, just taxing three games. It was a very easy season as far as just the, how I was able to control my body. And my mechanics had gotten way easier. But I will say this, having 08, you know, when I got my surgery, and it was almost like pushing recharge and rebooting all the systems, because I know in that 07 and in some of that 08, I'd started to kind of just back spasms and started to get all these things. My body, I wasn't training myself the correct way either. You've just been doing it for so long, so you just kept doing the same thing. And so when I got to Tommy John, and I was like, who knows what this is going to be? You know, I don't know if I'm going to come back the same, you know, so my whole regiment changed. I didn't pound the weights as much. I did continue to really train on the road a little bit more, endurance. My body had taken on. I did a lot more back work, and we'd always did Kibblers and things like that to really strengthen our backs and do these scap works and mm-hmm. you know, the rows and all that. But it, all of a sudden, it became a different way. I wasn't trying to build mass anymore. Yeah. I was playing this maintenance role, and I really focused on, with all the work you do when you have Tommy John with grip and I mean, that my arm never hurt. My arm today doesn't hurt. I mean, I throw BP. I still do things. You know, the things that kill me now are knees and back. But I mean, those are things, or ankles and you know, the feet and toes from dragging them and stuff. Those are the things that, you know, kill you now. But that, you know, everything was a little different just because, you know, I knew what I had to do. But I slimmed down, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't say my weight went down. I was in that 225, 230, and I was leaner. My body fat was in that 12, and but you know, I didn't know how this was going to work. I wasn't going to let anybody tell me it was over until I said it was over. And so that mindset kind of helped fuel the going in. But having that time off and missing that game and seeing everything, you know, once I got back, I mean, I remember stepping on the mound at Citi Field when I came back against the Phillies. And, you know, I'd thrown in rehab games and against A-ball guys and stuff like that. And, you know, but when I stepped on the field against the Phillies to get an inning, the ninth inning, my first outing, and I punched out three. I mean, it was like I never left. I mean, I didn't feel like I'd even tried to throw hard. And, you know, I'm sitting there 96, 95, and I'm like, you know, everything was there and probably a little bit better. But having that little break really charged my body up to have to have that season in 2010.
I'm gonna shift gears on you. So the game has evolved a lot since, you know, you retired after 2010. Hitters and pitchers are approaching the game a lot differently. You know, certainly at the highest level, you know, strikeouts are up, home runs are up, but also in kind of the quest to get to that level, right? We see guys selling out for huge velo and big time stuff, and maybe not worrying as much about command. But I'm also curious, like on the technology side of things, what innovations are available now that you look and say, hey, this could have made me really even better? And then what do you see right now that makes you scratch your head that you don't like, whether that's at the professional level or even at like the amateur development side of things?
Well, I mean, being old school is very hard to catch up with the new age, but being a high school coach makes you have to do that. Mm-hmm. I look into the blast sensors, mm-hmm. the Rapsodos for pitchers. And I think the things that it does is it clarifies the old school meanings of being able to do stuff like it gives them a visual. It gives the new age a visual aid to be able to do some of these things where back in the day, some of the things that just stick out to me is guys saying, hey, bend your back, throw through the catcher, things like that. I mean, you know, if I was walk out on the mound and tell a pitcher today, hey, bend your back, you know, I would have the funniest looking pitchers out there. But now you sit there and you talk about, you know, release points and spin rates and angles and, you know, all of a sudden they visualize that. And we put it in our bullpens to where, you know, they throw and all of a sudden they see the flight of their ball. They see where the ball breaks and you're like, oh, your break on your breaking ball is at 20 feet. Everybody sees it. Now you go, hey, you want to get that into that, you know, 9 to 10 radius. Or all of a sudden they visually see what they need to do way better than understanding in that conversation. And so, you know, that's the conversation you have. And in a lot of ways that has been really good. Rick Peterson was a big influence on me, and we would do close eye drills, and I would throw to catchers with my eyes closed to get a feel. Well, nowadays, I mean, we can still use that, but after we've fixed, you know, what they see physically, they have to see it before they can do it anymore. And so, you know, those things help a lot. I mean, you know, we never used them. And, you know, when you talk about the RPMs of spin rates, you know, we didn't need somebody to say, hey, your RPMs are this and your spin rate's that, so you can pitch up here. You knew that because of if you were pitching down the zone and you were backing up bases, you needed to do something different. And if you were pitching up, so you knew it. So now it's just a communication. I think it's the verbiage that allows these kids to, and the visual aids to sit there and go, hey, this works. And I mean, it is unique to look at and tie it. And I mean, you know, I do a lot of stuff training with travel balls and pro guys that'll still come in and stuff. And, you know, you got to have that understanding of what that means. And, you know, sometimes I can old school dumb it down, or sometimes I have to sit there and talk to these kids about spin rates and stuff. And that I like that. And I think it does have a benefit for these kids. It's just, you know, it's hard sometimes to put yourself in that new school frame, though.
I think you know, maybe two different answers separated by 20 minutes here. You talked a little bit about some of the stuff we discuss. Is my business partner, Brian, who works with our pitchers down here, he had a line. He said, you can't be analytical and competitive at the same time. You know what I mean? So you talked about the competitive mm-hmm. aspect of it, you know, what training like a football player, trying to find those, mm-hmm. that extra gear. You can't do that and crunch spin rate at the same time. You've got to have correct. Different designations for both of those things, but eventually they have to peacefully coalesce so that you're not thinking about that stuff when you're trying to, you know, strike somebody out with right. the bases loaded.
Well, practice is practice.
Yeah.
Practice is practice. And you practice so that when you walk out on the mound, you're not thinking. And so when I walked out, when I would throw bullpens and stuff like that, I was probably the world's worst bullpen guy. I don't know if I'd make teams if it was all based on bullpens, you know. And so I would go out but it's, you know, what am I working for? How do I use this? And that's the biggest thing, because you can paralyze yourself by going and watch a video. You sit there and watch yourself. I mean, I used to go watch myself and I would sit there and go, oh my God, because you start looking at results instead of what you're really there to look at. And so, you know, I mean, to a point, when you go out on the field, you want to be perfective, but you also want to be able to sit there and understand that, you know, if I get three outs, I don't care. I really don't care, because I'm not getting paid to look good. It looks good if I do, but if I get three outs and they don't score, you know, I'm going to get I'm going to get my just due. So I think, you know, tying those together.
That's an important message that I think gets overlooked, right? Because I think we have this kind of leads into I wanted to talk to you about, you know, being a baseball dad and being a baseball coach. We definitely have a generation of kids that have been sheltered from, you know, kind of failure, in the sense that, you know, there's an Instagram filter that can make any picture look good. You know, you can always go on the showcase rankings if you have a bad outing, but hey, you touch 95, so everything must be great. I think we have a lot of people that, you know, that do need to actually appreciate that, you know, that sometimes there are going to be bad outcomes, but you have to really evaluate your processes along the way. And if all you care about is how you looked out there and not how you actually helped your team or anything like that, that's a big deal. Do you see that in today's, you know, era of working with younger players?
Way more than ever. I mean, you know, it's the whole pitch count thing. If you go to Lake Point and these places and they have the velo up, I mean, you've got guys throwing and looking back at the same time. I mean, the game has evolved because everybody knows that it's a numbers game. You know, if I hit this number, I'll worry about getting that guy out later. I've got a junior right now that hits a ball like he averages like 104 exit. I mean, it's ridiculous to watch him. But, you know, it's one out of five swings that he hits that ball like that when he hits it. And so you're sitting here going, you know, but it is a numbers thing. And people, as soon as you post that and it gets on the Instagram and the Twitter and all that stuff, everybody's, you know, that's phone calls happen all the time. I mean, I've had kids that I've coached that, you know, when their stats go up on, I've had colleges call right away and they're like, hey, we really like this guy. And that, you know, how you crop the picture and they just show that one swing where the guy hits the home run and they're like, oh yeah, I like this guy. Hey, what, you know, we seen it where it's, you know, 105 or whatever. You're like, what? So, I mean, the game has changed but I mean, the kids haven't changed. We've changed.
Yep.
We've made it that way to where they reward themselves on the numbers. I mean, it's not how I got on base. It's how hard I hit the ball. What kind of hit was it? You know, if I get a guy out and it's a sharp hit ball to the shortstop and I'm getting out, you know, I see the pitcher coming off with his head down, shaking his head like, oh my God, you know, instead of going, all right, that boy. You know, it has changed because we've put them in a situation and say, well, if it's not 88 to 92, or if it doesn't have this type of sink or this, you know, plane, you know, it's not going to be successful. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, I feel like we've forgot to tell the kids that, you know, hey, this game's really hard.
Yeah.
This is a really hard game. And I want you to compete more than I want you to worry about numbers. But then they go and play travel ball, and it's, well, if you don't have these numbers, you can't go to this school. And, you know, who knows what colleges look for. I have yet to figure out any of that stuff. It's, you know, so I just try to train kids to go get people out, go get base hits, and run fast, throw hard, and do what you can control. So, but it has changed. It has changed to the point that team baseball and individual baseball are really separated now more than, you know, than it had been.
Did you find that the transition from playing to coaching challenging? Like, what were the big adjustments that you had to make on that front?
I didn't have any issue because I, you know, coming out, I'd had a great high school coach. Mm-hmm. He had always just been very positive. Had always, you know, I mean, I was little. I mean, I'm coming in. I wasn't this mega superstar when I left high school. I wasn't a mega superstar when I left. I was successful, but you know, when I came back, it was, you know, some of the things I've learned, these kids can't do. And I mean, we try to teach kids to swing like Bryce Harper or Aaron Judge or some these monsters. And so, you know, trying to create the foundation, and that was the biggest thing I thought about when I came in. I want them to enjoy the game. I want them to realize how hard this game is. I want them to have a great work ethic. And I really want them to compete. That's what I want, because when you compete, you don't take days off, you know? And so, you know, when I would meet with these kids and parents, I love to go, hey, where do you want this to go? Where do you see this going? And, you know, living right by the University of Virginia, I'd like to go and play at UVA. And I would like to, and so you're like, great. And, you know, parents will go, why do you, and then they go, hey, I'd like to have a chance to play Major League Baseball. And I'm like, that is awesome. And they're like, these parents are like looking at me like, what? And I'm like, I said, nothing better than hearing somebody say that, because you know what? I've been there, done that. And I can appreciate that. Now let me show you how hard this is going to be. So you're telling me that. So when I'm, you know, putting a foot in your butt saying, hey, it's time to go, now you understand. There's no excuse. You told me this is what you want. This is how it works. This, you know, there's no days off. We practice 5 days a week. We do this. And so all of a sudden reality sets in. And so they start to figure out what it takes. And so, you know, the adjustment for me was just not to allow the game to take over.
I respect that so much, the candor, you know what I mean? Like, because that doesn't happen in today's game. We have too many people that tell people what they want to hear. And you laid out, you know, here's where you want to be. Here's what it's actually going to take. I think we see way too many kids that are sheltered from that. Would you agree? Like, does it hit them like a ton of bricks when you bring that up?
Absolutely. And you know, the biggest thing is I go, guess what? I don't get paid to win here. Mm-hmm. You know, if I go out and we never win, you know, pretty much tells you I'm a bad coach, but it also says that I haven't done anything to make players around me give them a process to learn how to win, because the players will learn. The players want to win. Mm-hmm. I want to win, but it's a process in which they've got to learn. Hey, I want to win, and this is what it's going to take, and I'm not going to settle for anything less. And so once they buy in, all these things start to go their way, and it's not always easy. You have the late bloomer doesn't pop out and hadn't gotten an offer, and he's going into senior year, and all of a sudden, between winter and, you know, 2 months of January to March, all of a sudden he grows 2 inches and gains 10 pounds and he's hitting balls to the moon. And you're like, it happens so quick. But it's, you know, those are the things that I like about developing. I don't know if I'd say coaching, because I'm not a very good coach. I have very good players. And they, you know, they follow the process. I give them the opportunities, and I want them to fail. I think back in the day, you know, to tell a guy to dive or try to steal a base, you know, we steal third base all the time, all the time. I mean, if you ask any coach, they're like, wow, that's stupid. You know, stealing third base with three outs and oh my God, and all this. They tell me that all the time. I go, absolutely. I said, but I don't coach the book. I'm not here to, I'm not worried about winning this game. I said, if this guy does what he's supposed to do, your catcher ain't going to do right.
Yeah.
I said, it's just playing the game and teaching them that there is a consequence. Mm-hmm. But knowing that I got to be fearless, and I can't always be worried about the outcome, because so many kids will play apprehensive at this age. And they never – the best players don't always get seen because they're afraid of that failure. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a big proponent of, hey, let's let it eat, man. Let's go to work.
That's big. Give him a chance to fail with no consequences.
Absolutely.
and I'm curious, what are your mainstays for developing players, regardless of the era? So, and maybe we hone in on pitching, right? Is it the ability to command a fastball? Is it the ability to be unpredictable in classic fastball counts? What is it that you think is what are the key points that you emphasize to your young arms?
Well, I want to know who they are. Who do they think they are? I want them to figure out who they are first. And you don't got to have this big fastball. You got to have conviction and commitment. And if I have those, the heart to compete, and I'm up there throwing 78, 80, and I can compete by throwing it to locations. I know locations that I can't go, and I know locations I can go. And so I talk to them about finding out who they are, who they want to be. If they got to go out and take a couple beatings to figure out who they are. And they also got to have just enough success so that they go, oh, okay, yeah, this is possible. And so really I preach on competing. I don't really preach on sitting here going, hey, we got to have this type of fastball. I'm going to see who you are. And I coach all these kids so different. There's not a kid that's ever come through here that I've gone, oh, you know what? Kid A, you need to pitch just like Kid A. And there's similarities and we'll mix in. But to be honest, we talk a lot about just the individualism of each player is going, this is what makes you successful. Now, this probably won't work at the next level. So we need to work on this. And some of that's through maturity, and just physical. And as they grow, things change. And it's like, like a hitter, all of a sudden, they can't pull a ball, but now they grow a couple inches, gain some weight, get a few more muscles. All of a sudden they're pulling balls and now it's getting to the outfield. Now it gets to the fence. And so it's this progression. And I try to give these kids the opportunity to fail and understand what, the difference between failing and not doing what, and not achieving the goals they want are, because every time I walked out, I wanted to punch out three guys. I want to go out and punch out three guys. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, but yeah. If I go out there and let's say that guy on my first hitter swings first pitch and pops it up. Next guy hits a line drive to second base. Third guy I punch out. Well, you know what? I'm not going to walk off man and go, man, I suck. So I'm talking to these kids. I said, I want you to believe in being perfectionist, but I don't want you to go out there and be upset when it's not perfect. I want you to learn how to have like ebb and flow of going out there and this doesn't work right now, but this works and I'm going to compete with this. And so we really push long toss. Mm-hmm. We do a little bit of the tap ball kind of motion, trying to get all the everything going in the right direction. We do a lot of mechanic work. And in our bullpens, we use the Rapsodo, mm-hmm. but we really focus on strike zone efficiency. Mm-hmm. So if you can't throw a strike with a fastball, I can't call a breaking ball. And so who are you? And so once they figure those things out, the games, I don't really do much. I pretty much just sit and I watch and I try to, get pointers here and there, because in the hype of the game, kids are, they're emotional. They'll say just about anything. I mean, they'll snap and I don't want to agitate them, but I want to give them the, hey, you're look at this. Hey, this guy's doing this. Hey, watch this guy's glove. Just little pointers, just things that they all of a sudden they go, oh, and little calming things. I'm not a big yeller. I believe in pushing the positive. Now, after the game, if you aren't hustling and putting out, then I'm not your best friend. but those are the things that we're trying to install. But I think for the most part, I'll find out who you are, and then we're going to build on top of that.
I love that. So I'm curious, and this is maybe a little bit of a change of pace as well. What advice do you have for players who are smaller in stature, to A, get noticed, which I would assume is easier now than it was then because of guys like you, guys like Timmy, guys like Pedroia, mm-hmm. who have gone up and done it, but also succeed at that height. What would you say to the 5'7 kid, on a high school team that's listening to this?
Well, you have a dream. You can follow it. There's no reason. The road may not be easy, and it may not be that straight shot. You may not be a first rounder. You might be a free agent, but the dream's there. And as long as you're committed to pushing and working hard, that dream's always there and in front of you. For every successful thing that was said to me, there was probably two things negative. Oh, you won't last, or you're not, you don't have this, or you're too this, you're too that. There's always going to be the naysayers. It doesn't matter. And I mean, you have, but believing in yourself enough to understand that dreams are possible. You just got to keep putting yourself out there. And when you're looking for the type of goals of a Major League Baseball player, those goals don't come by easy. They don't just happen. You have to work, and you have to put yourself in some uncomfortable situations, situations to play, or you're not going to be seen. And so you have to go out there and take a beating to figure out how to be successful.
That's great stuff. Now, another one, and I'm actually really intrigued at your answer on this one, is which pitchers do you like to watch in today's game? Obviously the game is almost trending to who you were, right? Punching a lot of guys out, big velo. Like, who do you enjoy watching the most? And who would you recommend young kids watch as good models to learn from?
Well, I think everybody has their own uniqueness. I mean, Trevor Bauer's unique. Kluber, I always lean on Verlander because he's sort of a homeboy, even though he's out in L.A. or New York now. Yeah. I don't know. For me, growing up, how could you not want to be Nolan Ryan? Yeah. I mean, Nolan Ryan, that was who, and Dale Murphy. Those were two guys I just thought the greatest thing ever. And then right before when I got in college, all of a sudden you get Deion Sanders and Bo Jackson, and then, Ricky Henderson and guys like that. I think each person needs to be realistic in who they're looking at. Just see the consistencies that they do, not the antics or just the consistency of what their ability is. I mean, the ability to come in there and compete, and I think that's where when I'm looking at guys, I like how they go and compete. Rubber meets the road. Where am I going? Am I scared to throw a 3-2 breaking ball with a man on third? Or those guys that and I mean, your big game pitchers. I mean, your big game pitchers are big game pitchers because they're not afraid to fail. They're not afraid to put themselves out there. And I mean. Today's guys, I mean, the new age turnover, I tell you, I bet you I don't know probably 99% of the newer guys, just because, I mean, they're probably within 3 years of being in the big leagues. And so, I mean, now they're starting to get established. So, but I mean, the guys that, like you said, there's not too many starters that walk out there anymore that's not 93, 95. Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. Well, you've given us some really good insight. So I'm gonna also throw something out there. You're on the Hall of Fame ballot. This is your sixth year on it. Your 2.31 career ERA would rank you second among all Hall of Fame relievers. 422 career saves. I think there's only six guys out of the bullpen who have saved 400 games. And another one that's intriguing, 11.9 strikeouts per nine innings would be the highest of any major leaguer with at least 800 innings pitched. So what I think is those are statistics, but I think, when it comes to Hall of Fame voting, you're also looking at what someone did to grow the game. And it's very cool to see you not just hanging your hat on a great career, but also, continue to invest in the next generation of players. So this has been an awesome podcast, and you really deserve that vote. So hopefully you get some good news this January.
Well, I appreciate that.
Nice. Well,
that'd be fun.
Thank you very much for taking the time and for sharing your expertise. And, best of luck getting your guys ready. Hopefully you guys have a good high school season that actually takes place here in 2021.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd be thrilled if you'd consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving us a review to read on iTunes. We welcome your suggestions for future guests and questions. Just email elitebaseballpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for your continued support, and we'll see you next episode.